as missionaries with the ELCA, working in parishes, various parishes in Brazil. And we are currently here in the United States doing graduate work under the auspices of the Division for Global Mission of the ELCA, with the intention of going back to Latin America, probably Brazil, to teach in the seminary or a pastoral training center there. What we're going to do today, as some of you already know, is called Bricks, Bread, and Babies in the Beehive. And I only hope that the presentation lives up to the title. Someone said the title is intriguing. Obviously, there's a story behind the title. And it is one of our stories, one of our Brazil stories. And it's a story painted with the colors of joy and sorrow. It's a story marked by some joy, but a lot of frustration. But in order really to get into the story, we needed to connect it with some of your stories. And we're going to do just a little bit of that to start with. Most of you, no doubt, are members of a Christian congregation somewhere. Okay? So I want all of you to think, just for a moment, about your congregation, and then think about the city or the neighborhood that's around it. And ask yourself the question, how and where is my community, not the congregation, but the community around the congregation, hurting? In what way is it hurting? What is its ouch? In other words, what's the biggest challenge that the outside community or the city in which you are living gives to your congregation? What's the biggest challenge it gives to you? And I'd like just a few people that are...
No.
All right. Few people to say in a word or two, you know, whether it be poverty or unemployment or something like that. Let's just note those because we're going to be using them later on. Any ideas? Any comments?
Single parenthood,
okay.
Youth.
Single parents, okay. Problems with the youth in the city. Anything else?
That's drug abuse.
Pardon?
Drug abuse,
drug abuse. Okay. Some things that are in your city, in your community, that are signs of its hurting. Anything else?
How to handle the aged.
Aging, okay. The aging community, aging population, okay.
There's poverty.
There is some poverty, okay.
We have a lot of migrant workers. We have a different nationality.
Okay. Yeah. A changing neighborhood. It's changing.
Cultural clashes. Cultural clashes.
Okay, cultural clashes. Okay.
Homophobia.
Okay.
What does that mean?
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, explain.
Fear of the gay population.
Fear of gay population. Okay.
Re-education of the unemployed.
Okay. Re-education of the unemployed. Okay, anything else?
Alcoholism.
Okay. Oh, these markers smell good. Talk about drug abuse.
Getting high.
Yeah. Okay. Now we're going to be referring to these during our presentation, perhaps. Maybe some of our situations are related to your stories. And maybe what we talk about will help you think about your relationships and your congregation's relationship to these issues. Hopefully. That's our hope.
We're gonna start out this kind of this thought process by sharing with you what I think of as a very scary piece of scripture, a terrifying word here, and it happens to be in Matthew 7:21. Not everyone who calls me Lord, Lord will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only those who do the will of God. Does that say to us? Boy, being a Christian is more than saying the right words. I mean, I know the Lord's Prayer. Being a Christian is more than having the right feelings in your heart. Could it be? Is it more than being spiritual? Is being a Christian more than obeying the rules, being good, like Verlin is talking about here, you know, being okay, doing everything according to the rules? Being a Christian is having a living relationship with God and delighting in the love of God in Christ that Christ gives us. And being a Christian is responding to that love. So, how do we respond to God's love?
That's a real question.
That's a question.
It's a real question. This is going to be a dialogue. It's one we ask.
Right.
Generally, when we ask a question, we expect an answer. It's not one we're going to answer as soon as we ask it. Okay?
Right.
So how do we respond to God's love? Quick answers. You know, you have gone through Sunday school, some of you, confirmation. You know, how do we respond to God's love?
Obedience to Him as we know.
Obedience.
Mm-hmm. Doing His will.
Doing His will. Yeah. A lover responds to the love of the beloved by delighting in what the other wants. Doing the other's will. Huh? Your pregnant wife wants a pizza and ice cream at 3 o'clock in the morning, and you delight in going out to well. Okay. Now the tough question is, what's God's will? What's God's will? How would you answer that? One word, two words, three words? Anybody?
Let people think a little bit. Mm-hmm. He's hyper.
I'm hyper. Yeah, I'm.
It's God's will that we would love as God loves.
Okay. Let me note down some things. See if we can. Okay, so we got love. Okay? Anything else?
Love thy neighbor as thyself.
Okay. Love neighbor. Okay? And self.
As.
Yeah, I know. Okay, as self. Okay? What other things does God want?
And we're stewards. Good stewards.
Stewards. Okay.
Wants us to share with others.
Share.
His love.
Okay.
Be open to people.
Open. Okay.
The evangelists.
Evangelists.
Be joyful.
Okay.
Take some risks.
Risks. Okay. Good. I think we've got some direction here.
Now we asked a group of children from what they call the Vila. Vila is a poor area in Brazil. And we asked these children what they thought the will of God was, or what does God want them to have? What does God want? And they came up with their own answers, which we thought were very good answers. The children there in Guaíba said, God wants peace, health, love, justice, and a decent life for everyone.
I just remember as she said that, I remember I can see one kid saying, God wants us to have enough food to eat and maybe meat once a week. Mm-hmm. He was very much more concrete than we were, you know, we are with our lists.
So, these answers are all good. I mean, these are wonderful answers. The answers the kids gave were all good answers, too. And it's easy to answer these things in words, isn't it? But how about in deeds? How do we do it? And it's also easy to generalize. We can say things in broad terms, but when it comes down to the concrete, how do we do this? That's when the problem comes. For us, as well as for people probably in your congregation dealing with your particular problems there. So we want you to hold on to these stories and keep thinking about them in a more concrete way, because we're going to come back to them.
Okay. I have trouble. I was telling Lynn before, I have trouble talking in the city. And I said, I'll jump around. Okay, I want you to imagine now a city of 80,000 in Brazil. It's called Guaíba. That's the name of our city. It's got about 80,000 people. And tucked off, way off in the corner of this city, way out on the end, is a little congregation, St. Paul's Lutheran, made up of 100 families, 100 families out of 80,000. These families come from all over the city, scattered every little corner you can find. Most of them are of German background. Most of these families work in the factories in Guaíba, or they go into the city, about an hour's drive away, into the capital city by bus, and they work there. Most of them make less than $150 a month, okay? Maybe about half of them have cars. Very few have telephones, very few. They see themselves as a tiny group of Lutherans in an urban setting, huge urban setting, complicated urban setting, that doesn't know what a Lutheran is and could care less. Now, those of us who are from Minnesota and North Dakota, we somehow get the impression that Lutherans still are somebody and can make an impact. I think those people who live in Washington, out here in the West Coast, or areas where there aren't many Lutherans, Texas has a few too, though. There's some strong... But those people who are little tiny groups of Lutherans, I don't know how it is in your town, but know that sometimes being a Lutheran doesn't mean a hill of beans to the rest of the community around you. And that's sort of how they felt. Little lost little people sitting there in their little community in a big Guayba, big town of 80,000.
But about a mile down a little dirt road, well, you had to go down these little side roads to get there, in a little dirt road, the government, in a year right before an election, started a housing project, and it was aptly named Colmeya. Anybody know any Spanish here? Do you know what Colmeya is?
No.
I'm not sure if it's the same in Spanish as it is in Portuguese. That's one reason why we asked. But in Portuguese, the word Colmeya means beehive. And that's just what this place was. It was just a teeming, teeming place. More than 2,800 people quickly came into Colmeya, like almost from one day to the next. And they live in these more than 500 tiny little wooden houses. The government promised that there would be houses made out of stronger material, like brick. But the money that was filtered in for that somehow got sidetracked. And what came was wood. Raw wood, green wood. And what the deal was the people who were going to get these houses then had to build them themselves. The city, the politicians who wanted their votes, provided the materials and some help, some engineering, telling them kind of how to do it. Because they're all going to be the same. They're going to be tin roofs, and they're going to be about 15 feet by 20 feet in three little rooms with raw hanging light bulbs. At least they had some electricity, and one plastic water faucet coming out of the wall. You had to provide your own sink and get this kind of stuff. But the people came, and they started building them. And there was no other facilities. There were no stores. There were no police help there. No schools. No sewers. All this kind of was just left out in the raw. They had the basics. They had a roof over their head and walls around them. No windows. It was just close this wooden shutter, and then you were closed in. And so these houses got built and were full. And it just became a teeming place, just full of activity. And when we came there in July of 1988, the construction was just beginning, and we got kind of involved in the beginnings of it. Ron was out there walking around and making visits, and I got into it, and we were watching people build and pound and build their own homes. But we wondered, our congregation being the closest congregation to this new project, how can we get in here and help and start working with these people, do anything with them that matters? And what do we do? What is God's will for us in this beehive of people? Or should we go out there and shout, Lord, Lord? Should we plan worship services? Should we, what to do? What was God's will for us in this situation? Would you have any ideas? What would you have done? What would any of you have done?
Yeah,
can you imagine with us,
brother? I'm bring that down.
Yeah, we want some help.
There's a place.
Help us. Can you let your imagination run away with you and think about these houses? Most of them, being as small as I described, 15 by 20 feet, had 4 to 5 or more people living in them. There's no closets built in houses in Brazil. If you don't have a wardrobe, then what they had was either a mattress on the floor kind of stacked with whatever you have to wear and you have to clear it off at night, or many times no table, a bench. Some people would sleep in a hanging hammock. If they had a stove, a little stove in a corner. There.
But it was a place full of babies.
And mostly women and children. Men would appear once in a while, or there'd be some. We knew of kind of one kind of good, solid, traditional, what you call a family.
Yeah, well, there were more, but there were a lot of this. Especially
mothers with children, usually with several fathers, given others.
Okay, go ahead.
Did they need teaching? I mean, could you help the women in any way with the project?
Yeah, we want you to make suggestions, and we'll go on talking about what we did, but we just like.
So how helps the women.
Okay, teach. Teach women.
Teach the women what?
Healthcare.
No, healthcare.
Nutrition.
Okay, nutrition.
An outhouse too, if they need.
She said there were no sewers, but there were sewers.
Oh, there were.
They didn't have little septic tanks.
Oh, they had
septic. Cesspool kind of things. Which was a great blessing because, if that hadn't been there, that would have been a definite need. Okay, we had nutrition, and someone else said health.
Healthcare access.
Healthcare, okay.
Some kind of thing.
Okay, anything else? What could the church have done?
Childcare.
Was the water supply safe for them to make?
They had fairly decent. I think the water was.
The water was okay.
Yes.
Before they had the same water we were drinking.
Yeah, it was the same water we were drinking. As far as that goes, it wasn't that great. We were all in that together in that sense. Anything else? Any ideas of what the congregation could have done? What you would have thought of doing?
How about just providing some food?
Food? Okay.
A garden.
Gardening? Okay.
You could ask them what they needed.
Okay, ask them.
Helping with construction.
Uh-huh. Okay. My marker is
okay, the other
one. Yeah, fading. Construction. About the same story. I'm too short. See, I write construction.
Offer Bible study.
Bible study.
After you.
Mm-hmm. Everybody like that squeaky? Mm-hmm.
What about any vocational training or cottage industry or something to let them be self-sufficient?
Take
the green one.
Schooling for the kids.
Mm-hmm. Training. Schooling. Okay. I think I'm going to have to go on here. I'm running out of space. But I think you've got some good ideas here. We'll see what happens with them. Okay? Well, now we'll look a little bit at what we actually did or did not do, where we failed, what mistakes we made. This is a story. One of those few times missionaries come back and tell you about their failures, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Anyway, some of the things we did. We began to visit Kolmeya even before it was done, as Lynn mentioned. And I would walk around, chat with the people, you know, find out their names, introduce myself. And then when they started moving in, I went to the church headquarters and I got a whole stack of calendars that the church had produced, calendar posters kind of things. That were nice to look at, and because I thought of all these bare wooden walls, and I said, this would be something people would like. So I went door to door and handed them out, introduced myself, told them about our church, and wouldn't you know it, one elderly couple invited us to come to service, to have a service in their house. So we came, and we held a few of them, but there were some problems. For one thing, the houses were so small that they held only about 8 or 10 people in the living room. That's the most you could put in them. And I remember the first one we had, one little kid threw up in the middle of the floor. Also, the electricity wasn't hooked up yet. So that at night when we came, it was very dark. The streets were dark. People didn't like to go out at night in the dark streets. And we found out that just because they were living a foot apart, one house right after the other, didn't mean that they got along with their neighbors. And, you know, going into somebody else's house at night for something like a church service, well, they were a little iffy. Yeah? And also, they weren't quite sure how to relate to us. One of the first worship services, the lady said to us, she says, wait a minute. Who are you anyway? She said. I know you're not Catholics, Roman Catholics, because you said you're married to this woman. And we know the priests don't get married. And she says, and I know you're not Pentecostal, you're not from the assembly, because your wife's wearing earrings, and they don't allow earrings. What the heck? What the heck are you anyway? She said. And how would you have answered that question? How would you have answered that question? You go into a little place and you say, what would you have said?
How do you define
who you are as a Lutheran in 20 words or less? Huh? That was our problem, one of our problems. Huh? As I look back on this now, and hindsight is always better than foresight, and so our failures there, I would say we made some mistakes. And our first big mistake, our first one, mistake number one, let's just make a list of mistakes here. It's not very ego boosting to do this, but mistake number one, I went alone. From the beginning, I should have taken somebody along. But there I was, a pastor, doing the pastor's job, out there visiting people. I went alone. Second, I think neither Lynn or I gave an adequate defense of our faith that night. We talked a little bit, tried to say a little bit about what a Lutheran was and how it was different from what the other, but the ladies just sort of sat there. I don't think we did a good job.
We are trained people, we are intellectual people, Americans. And we worked with people who read. You get with people who don't read, who haven't gone to school, and they ask these simple questions that they want a simple answer to, and sometimes we're too much above them that we can't even relate. We need to talk on their own level.
And I think it works for all of us, though. I mean, how do you explain, in a simple way, what it means for you to be a Christian who calls himself or herself Lutheran? We didn't have an adequate defense. The thing fizzled out. After a few times, nobody came anymore, and this old couple would still let their house open. We came once, and it was just those two of us, and we sat there and talked a little bit, and found out they'd been going to other churches too, so that was no big deal. I mean, they were Christians already. Anyway, so that's what happened. First step.
That tactic kind of, we figured, okay, so this must be saying something to us, let's try something else. So we had an active women's group that met weekly in our church there, and we thought we'd talk to the women's group. They were usually concerned about the environment, concerned about the surroundings and the people. So what we did was we tied some of the benches. We had some straight, flat, simple benches in our church we could tie on the top of our station wagon. So we hoisted up two or three of them up and tied them on the top of the station wagon. And some of the women from the women's group went with us.
We didn't tie them on,
No. They rode in the car with us. And we drove out there and set these benches up in the street. We had no place. We set them up in the middle of the street, the sun beating down on us, the wind, the children running by, and the dust floating around. And we sat around. I brought my guitar. We started singing and talking to the women. And in Brazil, there's something called chimarrão. It's a special tea that you put in a gourd and you drink it through a straw. So you put water in it for each person and you pass it around. It's a community thing. So we had chimarrão and we started doing that. And women came, women with children. So pretty soon we had to branch that off and we had to do some activities with the kids to keep them a little bit quiet and separate so that the mothers could do something. They'd be swarming all over them. And a little later, it came that everybody who came would bring a vegetable or two and we'd get a pot of soup going in somebody's house boiling away. So at the end, they'd bring a couple of vegetables and a pan. So after we made the soup, they could each take a pan of soup, a mix, So the women from the church brought, plus the women from, so it was not just getting, it was giving and getting. And they would cut and chop while we were talking, and then we'd go put it on to boil while we were talking, and the group would go and we'd work on things. Then we did some projects I taught the women to crochet. But a simple thing like crocheting, so I thought, okay, I'll teach them to make something that they can sell. But the little thing, like comprehending how to crochet, is not that easy. And those who did catch on found that they had very little time for themselves to do it. They couldn't keep their hands clean enough. You'd come back the next time and the yarn you had, you'd be kind of white and they'd be getting yellow and they'd be kind of gray and your piece would just be, and it wouldn't be, stitches wouldn't be even. They had no time for themselves to work on it. Their kids would get into it. It just wasn't working out all that well, that project.
Just to do, when she talked about the dirt, just reminded me. I heard in the news the other day, this lady from Iowa someplace says, yeah, tomorrow I got to get into a car and drive 50 miles to take a shower and wash my clothes. Mm-hmm. And I said, now maybe she'll understand. You look at people, pictures of people from other countries, and you say, gosh, those people are dirty. Why don't they take care of themselves? You don't realize sometimes how hard it is for people to stay clean. And, you know, if you've got, all you've got is a little water coming out of a faucet, and you live in dust all the time, you don't necessarily choose to be dirty. It's just something that happens.
That little project, we managed to make about 3 or 4 skirts, and I did sell them in various places, and the money came back to help us with the project, which we'll get into later. But some other complications came up. A school where our kids went had a kind of a game in the spring where they had to go around and collect food, and the team that got the most food and won or something. And so the school ended up with all this food donations, and they didn't know what to do with it. And they gave it to us, to give to these people who are working with them. So the women from the church packaged up more than 100 food packages distributing these donations we've gotten. And so on one of our women's meetings, then we went out and we handed out food packages. Great. You know what happened the next week?
Yes, what do you think happened?
We had a great big group when we came. And when we told them we weren't giving out food packages this week, we were just going to have songs and discussions and do the same old soup thing we've been doing before, almost everybody left.
Yeah, we told them we were going to sit down and talk about the problems of the villa.
Yeah, and have songs and
work at solving our problems, and they said, you don't have any food? Gone.
So, pretty soon, the women from our church who had been coming with us started to quit coming one by one. And their reasons being, you know, after I go out there and see all the problems women have, I can't sleep very well at night anymore. Mm. Or they would just be too busy for some reason or other. That day that we were supposed to go, they'd always say, well, I got my sister's coming, or I have this, or I have that. And pretty soon, it was just me and Ron again. And so there we went.
And we...
We were still meeting with maybe 8 to 10 women of various faith backgrounds and having songs and prayers and discussion, but we didn't quite know where it was going and whether it should be just us doing it.
Yeah. And we didn't know what, I guess, as I look back on it now, we didn't know what to do with them.
Right.
We had 8 people that came every time we came, 8 or 10. Mm-hmm. So, but what did we want to do? Did we want to start a congregation?
Yeah.
Did we want to start a lobby group? Did we want to start an advocacy group?
A daycare center?
We didn't know and they didn't know. And we just sort
of... Some kind of vocational training, yeah, like was mentioned here.
Or someone said here, ask them, you know, what they want. Mm-hmm. And they didn't know, and we didn't know.
People like this who have grown up in poverty and have not had schooling, if they had a clear direction for their life, they would be on it. Mm-hmm. You know? It's just like us here. We've been through school. Do I know what I am yet? Well, maybe. Sometimes I think I'm this. I'm pretty sure. And then the next day, I'm not quite so sure. And when it's from one minute to the other, wondering what you're going to put on your table, your mind is pretty occupied.
Yeah. So we had no clear objectives. That was, I think, clear. And that was a mistake, maybe number 3. We as leaders maybe should have known ahead of time or had some notions of what direction we were going so that we could have at least said to them, we're going with you this way. As I look back on it now, we kind of, and that's why some of our people left too. They didn't know. They said, well, I don't know what we're doing out here. And we didn't either.
We were being companions and friends.
Yes.
But other than that.
But finally in November one year, we had a good idea. Or they had a good idea, the women. They said, why don't we build an oven? A community bread baking oven. That way we can build this oven and we can heat it up once a week. And then a whole bunch of women can bake their bread in it. And we use up a lot less wood. And then everybody can share it with them. Wow, finally we got something concrete. Good idea. Huh? Well, we had 2 problems. First problem, where are we going to put the oven? There was no community space. Huh? Everybody had their little house and their little yard. Little house, little yard. Dirty, dusty road in the middle. That was it. Where are we going to put it? Well, one of the women, Maria, who had a husband and 1 child, and her husband was working at the local factory, she said, hey, you can put it in our backyard. Sounds like a good idea. It was the only out we had. So we had our spot. Next problem, where do we get the money for the bricks? And the brickway, all this stuff. Well, he said, Roni was the husband's name, Roni said, well, I've got a friend who lives right here in the villa who's a bricklayer, so we got a bricklayer. But we still didn't have any money for bricks. Then Lynn had an idea. And she said, hey, why don't we have our friends and family in the United States send us Christmas cards? And you go down to the lumber shop and get scraps of wood, and we'll make plaques, Christmas plaques.
This was like October, November,
yeah.
So we
were thinking.
Something
she was
sell for Christmas.
So the women, so we got all these Christmas cards. My mother sent a ton of Christmas cards. Mm-hmm. And we cut off the words, and we had the beautiful pictures. The women sanded the boards and varnished them, and we put all little screws on the back. Very simple things, and we sold them. Huh? For 50 cents, 75 cents, sold them at our Advent meetings that we had in our congregation. So it was a good thing. Our congregation, you know, would say, what's this? I said, oh, we're the Women's Mother's Club out there selling these to build their bread oven. Oh, great. So they bought them. So we had money. So The thing started, the project started, and this oven grew and grew, and it was about this high, it was shaped like a, and it had a little hole in it, and actually it got bigger than I thought, and they needed more bricks. The bricklayer said, we need more bricks, we got more bricks. Finally it was done, okay, and I'm all excited. I said, great, we're gonna have an inauguration, an opening ceremony. I already had written something all out about bread and the bread of life, and thought about how the community had come together and worked on this thing. And I finally was all set, the day marked, and I came out there on my bike and parked my bike, and I looked, and there was a big padlock on the gate. And I looked in the door, there was even a bigger padlock on the door, and I thought, uh-oh, what happened now? And I turned to leave, because there's nobody around, nobody around. And here comes Ronnie running up the road. He said, oh, brother, he called me brother. Brother, he said, bad news, he said. My wife just ran away with another man. I said, oh, no. He said, yeah, she ran away with that damn bricklayer. Oh, no, that's what I said. Evidently, now I knew why the stupid oven was so big. I mean, the guy strung out the project as long as he could. Romy would go off to work. The bricklayer would show up. He'd lay a few bricks. He'd go visit Maria. And then we found out later that the thing was too big. In fact, it burned up so much wood that it wasn't cost efficient after all. And so there we were again, back to zero. You know, and I wondered, what, you know, does God want us here? And as I look back on that situation, it was really funny. Huh? Could I have prevented this failure? Could I have prevented it? And as I sat and talked to the women, I said, geez, who'd have thought? And they looked one to the other and said, well, we knew what was going on. But we were too embarrassed to tell you. They knew darn well what was going on. It's that I didn't live in their world, see? And I couldn't see it. I couldn't perceive what they saw. It's not easy entering into another world like that. So when I look back on it now, this is about 2 years ago this all happened. I think mistake number four was not being close enough to the people.
So that all happened after Christmas, early January. January, summer there. So we have our summer Bible school. And we started this. This is something that the people had never had before. They didn't know about Bible school. And so, you know, imagine the excitement of the kids coming in the summer. And we had it outside in the churchyard. And having stories and songs and lunch and activities. And they just loved it. Whereas kids here sometimes are forced them to go. It was thrilling. But, so we decided to send our car, someone would take our car out to the Villa Comea and bring in any kids who'd want to come to that home, to the Bible school during the summer. A lot of them came for the lunch, of course, which was great, and then some of their parents came when we had the final service on Sunday, and we thought that maybe we were making some progress. But then in March, summer vacation ended, and we had Sunday school every Sunday, and we still would send a car out there. Or we had a program with the kids once a month on Saturdays. But when you live in a situation of poverty, you don't have a calendar, you don't have a watch, you don't know what day it is, you don't know what time it is. They wouldn't know it was Saturday. They wouldn't come to the place we were going to pick them up. And you didn't have time to send someone around house to house every time and gather them up.
It's like living in a beehive. You can imagine.
Can you imagine, you know, living without a schedule like that, living, your mind is that we can't understand their world. We can't understand not knowing what day it is and what time it is. What? And so that kind of diminished, and sometimes we'd have 10 kids there, and sometimes we'd have one or two or three, and pretty soon that started to dwindle down again, too. And so what we thought was we'd go out there and have meetings with the kids. But then again, we had the same problem with the house being too small. We'd go house to house with all the kids and gather them in, and we'd have them sandwiched one on top of the other in this house. No table to work on, no place to sit. And so that didn't, it worked. We kept doing it for quite a while. But
then we went to the council.
That had problems. Oh, yeah. So then Ron and church council, women's group president and church council president, we'd go to the city council to try to get a community center for that area. So we'd have a place to meet. And they kept telling us, don't worry about it. We'll build a community center there when the time is right.
Yeah, we, the city, would.
Yeah. So we didn't know when they thought the time was right. It was not our time. It was their time.
And since, I don't know if you were going to mention, but it seems to me the government, sometimes the government's it's to their advantage for the people to stay divided and dependent. So that you sometimes wonder, well, when is the time going to be,
We did manage to find some other people willing to work with us there. A social worker and a nurse started doing classes out there. They had the same problem. They had to go and invite people every time, tell them what day it is and what time it was, to someone's house. But they did start doing some good things there too. So what we want to bring up again is why desperate people don't come to helping organizations.
Does anybody have, maybe you've worked with people who are in desperate situations or who are living in a beehive. Why don't they come? Does anybody have any clues, any notions of that?
Well, I think that they feel that we don't understand what they're going through.
Jeff?
Change is threatening in any culture.
Pardon?
Change is threatening.
Yeah, so sometimes even their setting, even if it's miserable, is more, you know, it's the misery they know.
And if they go to any other organization other than what they do know, they may end up in more difficulty than they are now.
You never know.
I think what you said was very apt, you know, changing what they know, what being, they are so preoccupied with satisfying immediate needs, any kind of a program of change or a program of development would take them off their track of getting enough food for today. You can't look ahead like that.
Well, for most of them, future is the next meal. Mm-hmm. You know, or you know, maybe will I have enough food at the end of the week? That's as far as you can look.
You know, if it's something called free medicine or free food or, you know, some immediate relief, that they'll show up for. But anything where they would be involved in a long-term process of changing things is not as easily grasped and not attended.
Yeah. So you know, if you handed out free medicine, they would come. If you handed out free seeds, they might come and they might take them. But they get to the planting and the tending and the watering. Well, I didn't have time to water, Pastor, or I didn't have time to weed this week because I was out scrounging for food all. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a difficult problem. Huh? And I think.
Well, now we have another mistake.
I think one mistake that we make sometimes, or that we have to be aware of, is that we have to look at immediate needs as well as root causes. You can't go in and say, well, we see that the root cause here is underemployment, and we've got to work at that. And they say, no, my real problem now is food. And you want to work on the underemployment, which is really the root cause, but they want to know the immediate problem. Huh? So you've got root causes.
That kind of goes back to that story of don't give a person a fish, teach them how to fish. But you can't teach them how to fish when their stomach is empty. They won't be able to learn it.
And so somehow, one of our friends said you got to do both. So you maybe hand out free medicine, but you also at the same time do the health training. Somebody mentioned, you know, teaching them about. But you can't, if you just say, we're going to have a class on nutrition, nobody comes. But if you could say, we're going to give everybody who comes a pound of flour, and then while you're there, we're going to teach you about nutrition, then they'll come. Because you see what I'm saying?
The nutritionist that we got, the social worker and the nurse, then we got classes going where they did, we're learning to make nutritious meals out of a chicken liver that they could maybe get real cheap from the store. Banana making peels. Jelly from banana peel. Do you make things from banana peels in this country? Stretching potato peelings. Many women worked as maids. While they were at their family home, they could wash very well the potatoes they were going to peel and make for the family. If they brought those potato peels home and fried them, they would be very nutritious for their own family. Things like that, ways to get around the...
We know women who, that's how she kept her kids alive, on the potato peels, that she peeled up the potatoes for her boss.
There were also women who filled their kids' stomachs with newspaper balls. You take newspaper, it's a fiber.
That's just to keep...
Butter trees, vegetables.
Well, it's not very nutritious. It's something that keeps your stomach full.
You roll up a piece of newspaper, and if you want to, you can roll it in some flour and you fry it. It fills your kid's stomach so they don't cry all night.
Mm. We knew people that were desperate. We know women who sold their clothes. I know one lady, she said, things are tough, but they've been tougher, she said. I sold my pots and pans and my clothes off my body. I had one pair of clothes left to keep for food one week. It was really tough. You know, we're talking desperate. Yeah. Anyway, to get back to Colmea, our church had two clothing drives during this period of time, and we take in clothes, and then we take them out there to Colmea, and we sold them for a nickel or a penny a piece. We found that selling them, even, you know, for next to nothing, is better than giving them away, because the people have who need them can afford them, and at least they say, well, no, I bought it at the rummage sale.
And they can also choose. If you give a handout, you can't go and select, I want this and I want this.
So that way it was a good, and then the money, a little bit of change that came in was supposed to be used by the Mother's Club. Well, the first one, Lynn and I and some people from the church kind of organized and ran. The second one, I said, well, you women in the Mother's Club, you know how to do this, you can do it. Oh yeah, we can do it. And I came back and I found that they had fought over the nickels and the pennies. And one woman took it all, and the other women were angry at her. We never talked to her again because she'd taken all those nickels and pennies, probably amounted to $1 or $2. And finally, over and over again, we kept saying, does God want us to do something out here? Does God want us to work in Colmea? What should we do? And we asked that question so many times over the space of these years. And every time we asked it, we were reminded of our failures and of our mistakes. Because there we were, standing in the midst of a crying, hurting people, and we didn't know what to do. Now I suppose, maybe, some of you are saying, well, but your heart was in the right place, and that's what counts. Good, I'm glad you're not. Why not? Why wouldn't you say that? Wasn't my heart in the right place?
Yes.
It's not enough.
Yeah. And you could say it counts. What, who does it count for? For them? For me? Huh? Mm-hmm. Why wasn't it enough? Why doesn't it count? Why isn't it enough to have your heart in the right place?
Sometimes when your heart is in the right place, you're doing it for you and your feelings of being Christian, mm-hmm. rather than doing it for them. Their very real needs.
Yeah.
Completely discount what you've learned as a Christian, perhaps, as a Christian helping others, and listen and educate yourself about what they need, and forget your mm-hmm. need mm-hmm. as a Christian. Mm-hmm.
Anyone else have a reflection on that?
Well, what they really did need was basically food. I mean, shouldn't they have really been fed, first of all, and then the other? How would we feel in that situation? Mm-hmm. How would we be? Mm-hmm. If we didn't have anything, I think we probably, too, would feel that the food was first clean water and the food were what we would want. And then from there on, I would think that they would be so undernourished that they could hardly even think right about having something to fill their stomach.
Yeah.
Okay, but how concretely could we have gone about doing that?
We had a hundred.
I don't know. I'm just saying. Yes. You know, that seems to me.
Could we have just asked our congregation, contribute every week, and we're going to bring this free food out there? How concretely can you? You know, think about these things, schooling and all these things. These are grandiose things.
We had 100 families in our congregation, and some of them were living little better than the people out there, mm-hmm. and. It was very difficult for those 100 families to even think of mission. And that's why the women who, I mean, I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just saying
we're still wondering.
Huh? But I think...
envisioning in this that...
I think when we say your heart is in the right place, and that's all that counts, that is not enough. Now, on the one hand, we know that our relationship to God does not depend on our success in Colmea. Or anywhere else. We have been called and into a family by our baptism where we are free to fail. Huh? We are free to fail. On the other hand, I also believe that God wants our loving action to be effective. Failure is no virtue. And I think that God wants to use us and our congregation to be effective instruments in His mission.
But I think, you know, really when we think about it, I think the word failure and success are maybe the wrong words to use, too. Because when we think of the relationships that we had and that we built with those children and those women, they are each individually, not worrying about how numbers or having a worship service or if their life was made better on a certain level. That was already some wonderful blessing and success to us and hopefully to them in the individual relationships that we build between them, each other, getting to know each other, and becoming more of a community among themselves and the place.
Do you think they just said you were a failure?
That's what I was going to say.
I don't think so. They always wanted us to come, and they kept saying, when are you coming?
I think you're too hard on yourself. you look at any kind of growth, and you have to crawl before you can walk.
Yeah, let's write some things down. I think some insights are coming out. Okay, patience. You're talking about patience?
No, normal process.
Okay.
A baby, any kind of growth of anything, you don't start out with the mega. You start, when the baby can lift up its head, you're real glad.
Yeah, we had to face that in learning the language. Uh-huh. You start out as a baby, you talk like a baby.
The hard part of that is seeing, realizing, yes, this is going to be slow. How many are going to die before we, how many babies are going to die?
But that's not your problem. You don't control life and death.
Yeah.
You're the servant.
Yes, you're right.
And you found out some things that you needed to know, that those things didn't work, or what didn't work, it might be as important as what didn't work.
Sure.
Did the nutrition thing ever help at all? Did they ever get anything from the classes?
I think they did.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
We also, later on, then I started doing a painting thing where the women learned to paint on towels and things, and then they could do some of that and sell it. And
I think with the nutrition thing, that was Jill and this other lady. Mm-hmm. We did some one thing. Sometimes the thing you least invest yourself in. Finally, I reached the end of my rope, and I was so tired. Because I was working with four other congregations at the same time, and supposed to do worship services all over the place. Besides this, and people in the congregation just didn't understand. They couldn't free themselves to help there. But I found a group in the capital city that worked with community building. They were not directly connected with the church, but they were interested in helping communities organize. And so what I did finally, I talked to them. I said, "Why don't you come out to our area?" "Well, it's not really in our area." "Well, come on out anyway. Come on." And I was hassling them until finally they came out. And they started having meetings. And I said, "Oh, good. I got to quit. I can't handle it anymore." And after they stuck with it for 6 months. And then finally one day the city started building that community center. And then a year later when I came out, there was a mother's club meeting that was holding. They were holding meetings. They were doing classes on their own. And I said, "Well, who knows? I mean, maybe there was an opening that we had that threw a seed in, and something happened." Also, I think that we needed to learn something from the way the Pentecostal churches worked in that villa. There is no Lutheran church in Colmea, and probably never will be because of the way Lutheran churches are set up. But the Pentecostal churches did like this. They found one of their members who was poor and said, "Why don't you go out and live in Colmea?" And they did. And they said, "Now you are out in Colmea, now you start a church in your house. And you hold services there. You have Bible studies there every night. And they'll be your neighbors, and they'll come." And they did. But see, what we did, we sent cars out to bring them to our church. And they said, "No, we'll put the church right there. And we'll be there with them. And we'll be with them." And so now there are churches out there. And one guy who happened to belong to an Assembly of God, a Pentecostal church, but he told me, he said, "You guys were the first ones here, and you were doing better work than anybody else. Why didn't you stay?" I said, "Because we had nowhere to go." And I was doing it with my left hand, because my church council said, "With the right hand, you've got to take care of the parish." Yeah? And these people aren't paying the bills. And the way our Lutheran church is set up, we don't do very well in those kind of situations. So that's one thing I learned too, strategies and the way structures can sometimes impede mission.
So I think our time is really.
What time is it? Yes, it's time to eat, isn't it?
Yeah. No.
So we've got 5 minutes.
1 o'clock is the next thing.
Oh, that's right. We can't do it.
We can't eat yet.
But it's hot here.
Well, we want to let people go.
But maybe.
I just want to leave you with.
I'm just wondering if there are any insights that you might take from this that you could apply to your situation. How you might think of your own situations differently. What we could have done differently. I appreciate your words of encouragement. Those are nice. And I think you're right.
Yeah.
We have to be more patient. Realize that any change is painful, slow, maybe unnatural.
More often than not, positive. Mm-hmm. Because even if it's a negative change, it has caused something else to happen. Mm-hmm. And the positive may come out of that.
Yeah, yeah.
You told us people, there's something better for you. Maybe mm-hmm. we can't do it, but the city can do it with the center.
Yeah.
Probably the first encouragement mm-hmm. those people ever had that, you know, mm-hmm. life, there is something
else.
Is another human being that thinks better of you than what...
Valuing them as people. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the valuing people is probably the biggest thing you can do. Huh?
You know, they're God's mm-hmm. creation.
Yeah.
Have worth.
Yeah.
You know, I'm really amazed at hearing you talk about your situation in a different country. I'm a pastor in a suburban congregation, and we're trying now to begin to ask questions about the, you know, why aren't we growing, and why are we remaining the same? And I'm looking at your mistakes, and thinking about, I could, the temptation would be to do it alone, mm-hmm. rather than to get some people to do it with me. No clear defense of what it is that I believe mm-hmm. Christ. Three, you know, we don't have objectives as to what we're trying to do. Four, you know, kind of getting close, not close enough to the people. If they see me as a person who's here for a little while, I'll probably be gone. And finally, to look at, well, what if people don't come? What are the root causes? And what are some immediate concerns that those people have? Now, that's amazing to me that you people talking about a third world country, very, very poor situation. I'm talking about a relatively affluent suburb, mm-hmm. and it seems to me that it works.
Sure.
It's the same concerns. If we're going to be the church in that place, we're going to have to do some of the same process that you people did there, that same struggle.
Sure.
Anytime you work with individuals, the first thing that you must overcome is the development of value within themselves. Mm-hmm. Once they start to value themselves and value what they have, then they start ownership. And once they start ownership, then they start doing.
Sure, exactly. Let me just briefly mention what we're going to be doing in the next sessions, and then Lynn will close our session today. First of all, how many of you heard where the Ed Marquardt session last night. I think what he said we would affirm in the sense that mission, whether it's done in Brazil or here, faces the same issues because we don't live in a Christian country. We live in a culture that has other values at work too. And we address, you know, we need to wrestle with those issues, whether poverty or non-Christian secularism or whatever it is. And we need to be clear about what direction we're going. Tomorrow, you want me to say? You want to say? Lynn's going to be doing some things.
Tomorrow.
Yes.
Okay, tomorrow? Yeah. Tomorrow, we don't usually work where we sit down and talk and people just sit there and respond. We like to work more with, I was calling it visual theology, but I think really what I do is corporal theology. And it kind of brings back the idea of that we aren't just heads and ears and butts. We have more to us than that. And how we can express our faith and how can a church get moved to action if they don't do anything but sit in church? How can we carry forth if we aren't corporal people? And how can we be God incarnate if we aren't? And so tomorrow we're gonna move. It's nothing difficult, nothing that anybody, I don't like to call it liturgical dance because I'm going to do a liturgical dance tonight in Vespers, and what we're going to do here tomorrow in the group is not liturgical dance. It is the body of Christ living in each of us.
And the last session we're going to be doing on Thursday evening is called The Song Reveals the Heart. And we're going to be looking at some of the differences between Lutheran theology and what has been called liberation theology. And we're going to be doing that through singing. We're going to be singing together some songs from the LBW and some songs from the liberation theology songbooks and look at the differences, how they analyze and look at the world.
There will be in English, though.
There will be in English. We will maybe sing a song in Portuguese just for you to hear it. And maybe if you're interested in doing some reading before that session or later at home, there's a book over in the bookstore called Luther and Liberation, a Latin American perspective written by a good Brazilian named Walter Altman. He's a Brazilian, German background, but a Brazilian-born professor at the seminary in Brazil, where someday perhaps we'll be teaching, and a good friend of ours. And he's written a book that looks at Lutheran theology and liberation theology and does some interesting comparisons. And if you're interested in that, you might take a look.
You might look in the bookstore if the book has come in, Brazilian Songs of Worship that we already did.
Oh, that one's the other one.
Brazilian Songs of Worship, they ordered in, it wasn't in on
yesterday.
Saturday. It may be in. Okay. Anyway, what we want to close with is that life, homeia, our own lives, are complicated and they're confusing and full of all kinds of problems, resistant to change. But that we are called to Christ, by Christ, to be in those situations, even though they're beehives. We might get stung, and they're crowded and uncomfortable, and we need to be there and listen to the buzz and reflect on where we are and what we are in the midst of, and act in some way. We might stumble, and we might get used, what we might call getting used, but we need to get up and learn to act again. And so that God is not just something we think and talk, like the saying, Lord, Lord, but it is something that we do. So that we hope that we're freed by love of God to act and do the will of God. So we thank you all for coming.
Thank you for coming.